Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. Not through speeches and majority decisions will the great questions of the day be decided, said Otto von Bismarck, but by iron and blood. Under Bismarck's leadership, Germany was transformed in the space of a generation from a disparate collection of princely states into a scientific, industrial, and imperial titan. Historians have long debated Bismarck's role in the founding of the first unified Germany in 1871. How did a second son of Prussian aristocrats, a wild child in his youth, the crazy Junker, to his drinking companions, rise to become one of Europe's most formidable statesmen? Why did Germany unite under Prussian military rule rather than as a democracy of equal states? And did Bismarck's unique brand of authoritarianism presage the dark days of the Third Reich? To answer these questions and more is Katja Hoyer. Her new book, Blood and Iron, tells the story of Germany from the humiliation of Napoleon's invasion to the calamitous First World War. It is the story of a nation created and destroyed in war. Katja, thank you for joining us. Histories of this era in German history have often viewed it in light of what happened next. The hyperinflation of Weimar Germany, the rise of Hitler. You raised British historian A.G.P. Taylor's famous Sonderweg theory that with Bismarck, Germany was set on a special path to the horrors of Nazism. Is that theory still defensible?
I don't think it is. I mean, mostly the consensus in Germany and elsewhere, I think, has moved away from that in any case. But there is still, certainly in popular history and in the way that people perceive German history kind of more widely outside of academia, I think that theory has had such an impact over time that it still lingers. I mean, you see this a lot, you know, that sort of this idea that Germany entered some sort of descent into darkness, you know, as sort of Ian McGregor, for instance, phrased it in his excellent work on kind of German memory culture. That's still around, and it's almost casual, I think, in the way that people use it. And that was one of the themes I wanted to address in the book, is that kind of this early phase of German national history from its beginnings in 1871 needs to be treated on its own terms and looked at it in its own terms. Of course, you know, it's got ramifications that echo into the 20th century, but this idea that that's predetermined, almost it's set up in a particular way, and therefore it had to end in Nazism and the Holocaust and all the other things that are normally associated with it, I think is taking it too far, and that's, I think, widely accepted within academia now.
In German historiography, did the Sonderweg theory ever have any sort of impact, would you say? And sort of when did it change?
Well, it did have its followers. I mean, I suppose the biggest debate around these things naturally happened sort of after the Second World War, when people were asking themselves, you know, why did war emanate twice from German soil? Why is it seemingly kind of escalating further from the First World War to the Second World War? You know, especially in light of the Holocaust as that was unraveled in the post-war trials and so on. You had Fritz Fischer, of course, with this famous sort of, you know, theory of kind of trying to collate the two and you know, Prussia as well as a theme, you know, was it Prussian mm-hmm. militarism that connected the two? So there was some traction with that in Germany as well. And I would say perhaps even more strongly that's still there, in that, you know, there's a kind of fear almost of German nationalism and German militarism resurging at some point, and then there's a lot of effort made by German politicians and writers of history and you know, by public discourse to try and avoid that almost. So I would say, you know, in its sort of less specific form, I mean, people don't necessarily call it the Sonderweg, but the ideas of it, I think, are still very much around.
The towering figure in this saga is, of course, Otto von Bismarck. There had never been a Germany without Bismarck, you write. So who was this man?
He's a complex character. I mean, he's often, I think, reduced to this almost caricature of
the blonde giant.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, people don't even realise that he's blonde because they just picture him with this, like, pickle halber on his head, you know, as this kind of arch Prussian that he was. I mean, you know, you can't get away from that. But he was a very, very complex man. I mean, you know, even as a private individual, very, very well read, keenly intelligent, very versatile in the language that he used, which he was able to adapt so specifically to the particular context of, you know, who he was speaking to, which was noticed very early from childhood. So that must have just been like a sort of intrinsic talent of his, that he had the sort of verbal ability to persuade and to cajole and to threaten people into doing what he wanted them to do. But he was also a doting husband in many ways, which he combined, strangely enough, with having lots of affairs with other women, often bragging about it to his own wife, who somehow put up with it. I mean, bless her, she was, you know, the patience of an angel, really. But Johanna von Puttkamer, who he married, was really a rock and a source of like stability to him at home, which then enabled him to sort of go out and then, you know, pick the arguments and the conflicts that he picked, and that's all part of, I think, who he was as a person as well, which I didn't have that much space and time to go into in the book, but that's kind of at the back of my mind, you know, when I was trying to portray Bismarck in the way that I have done in the book.
And it's hard to sort of know if he's likable or not, or maybe he's both. He's both likable and horrible.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I don't think it's a secret that I veer more towards the likable side of things, because I just can't get away from the fact that even, you know, looking at his letters and documents and stuff, that there's a really strong personality that sort of echoes through those and resonates with people, and certainly with me still today. But equally, you know, when you look at his relationship with the Poles and his almost pathological hatred of them, you know, there's also something quite nasty underlying that as well, which is also part of his character.
What is interesting is that, you know, we remember him also for his speeches, but was he really an orator? I mean, you talk a bit, you write a bit about his voice, for example. So how would you describe his way of speaking? And
yeah, it's an interesting one, because people describe his voice as almost kind of reedy, quite brittle, not particularly impressive. But equally, everyone that was there and heard him speak talks about, you know, what a great orator he was. So I think it was his physical presence, first of all. I mean, he was a giant of a man, you know, so huge bear-like figure, who just, as you say, with his blonde hair, steely blue eyes, just dominated the room when he walked in. Apparently also had a kind of uncanny habit of just staring at people when he talked at them or with them, you know, which normally you kind of look back and forth when you talk to somebody, and he just kind of stared and held people's gaze. And also his word choice was so evocative. Like, he would just pick exactly the right tone and the right voice, and the sort of right phrases to convey what he wanted to say, and also kind of do it with a lot of emotionality. I mean, there were instances where he just burst into tears in the Reichstag, you know, which you don't really expect from a 19th century politician as such, you know, in a sort of formal environment.
How was that sort of perceived and received? What did people think about a thing like that?
Well, what he was trying to convey, I think, and perhaps quite cynically as well, I'm not always convinced that this emotion was entirely real each time, was just a certain degree of passion or urgency, you know, to go with his words. He used it with the Kaiser in particular quite a lot. So when they had conflicts with Wilhelm I, that is, over, say, what to do with the socialists, or, you know, whether the way to deal with Catholicism was really, you know, as brutal as Bismarck eventually did it, he would just burst into tears and say, oh, but the Reich is at stake, and, you know, where's this going to go, and we need to do something, we need to do it now. And that created suddenly a sense of urgency, you know, that would just make the poor Kaiser give in and go, fine, you know, if you think it's that bad, then we just got to deal with this. And the ultimate kind of weapon in his arsenal was always to threaten to resign, you know, and then to combine that with the sort of outburst of tears was quite a powerful, you know, kind of nuclear option to pick when he needed to.
Well, one of the many coincidences that emerged from this story is that Bismarck is born in 1815. So the same year Napoleon is defeated at the Battle of Waterloo. So tell us what Germany looked like in 1815. How did the Napoleonic Wars shape German national consciousness?
Quite a lot. I mean, I start the book there somewhat cheekily, despite what it says on the cover, because I think that is a crucial moment in German history, because before the Napoleonic invasions of the German lands, you've got this messy patchwork of over 400 different states, all doing their own thing. being very, very loosely united and under the sort of, you know, auspices of the Holy Roman Empire. But there wasn't really a sense that they belonged together in any shape or form. And then suddenly this invasion changes everything, because here's a foreign enemy who's very clearly different from the Germans by the fact that he speaks a different language and comes from a different cultural background and is invading the German lands. And he's able to sort of pick the German states off one by one, either through, you know, sort of offering them deals or actually defeating them in battle. And that only works because they're disunited, and that creates a sort of spark in these different German peoples, who suddenly realize that they all have something in common in that they all want Napoleon out. They all speak a, you know, remotely kind of similar language. And had they stood united, Napoleon would have found it much more difficult to, you know, kind of invade and take them on as a big kind of, you know, one Germany. And that's, I think, a realization that people take in that time period, actually a bit earlier in sort of 1812, roughly 1812, when they start to fight back, starting with the Prussian king finally getting a grip and calling his people to arms, and then fighting back basically. And that's creating, in my opinion, a sense of defensive nationalism that will kind of be the driving factor behind future conflicts as well.
A second key year is 1848. And that year, democratic revolutions sweep the continent, toppling monarchies and forcing others to issue liberal constitutions. How close did the German liberals come in 1848 to realizing a democratic German unification?
It came quite close to achieving something. What that something was, whether it's a liberal revolution or not, that's I would contest that. But just because it was such a messy, loose, like, alliance of different people out on the streets who wanted completely different things. I mean, Marx had just written his Communist Manifesto, yes. So you've got communists out. You've got people that just want food. You know, yeah. There's been all of these horrible kind of harvests that didn't really work out in the early 1840s. So a lot of people are just miserable. There's the misery in the cities, and all of that combines into a cocktail of different ideas. And what they know is that the people responsible, or the people who could do something about that, is the aristocracy. But they all want quite different outcomes out of that. But it is interesting that when the people that basically end up talking to the authorities and to the aristocracy are, of course, the middle classes, because they're there and they've got the sort of power and the means to do that. And they offer at this point Frederick Wilhelm IV the crown and say to him, you know, you can be the German Kaiser rather than just the Prussian king. But you must tie this to a constitution and to sort of certain, you know, the rule of law and certain other liberal concepts. And he turns it down and says, I'm not taking this crown that, as he says, comes from the gutter, you know, not from God, but from you mere mortals. that's not how this works, you know, and just turns it down basically. And then briefly makes an effort to sort of appease them. So, for instance, the Prussian parliament comes out of this as a pretty strong institution and actually stays that way as well. But then pretty much turns around and suppresses all of these, you know, uprisings in brutal fashion. A lot of people flee to America, famously. It's this kind of 1848, a generation of Germans that flee to America, mostly intellectuals. And that's that for a little while.
Well, but years after the revolution, see order restored. So, though we'd experienced trade unions, so such as single market, the Zollverein, but it takes another war with France to finally seal the deal. Is it fair to say that Bismarck plotted the Franco-Prussian War?
I think so.
Why?
I mean, it certainly wouldn't have. Because it was let's go back on that a little bit. Because it wasn't a good idea from a French perspective to attack. I mean, they knew that this wasn't a good idea, because there was this idea in French kind of war gaming that the Germans have kind of got two for everything that they've got one, be that people, resources, money, whatever. So they're hugely outnumbered and on every front that matters with relatively modern warfare. And so attacking Germany or Prussia even seems a pretty silly idea at this point. And it took a good deal of provoking to get the French to a point where they make this fairly irrational decision to attack, basically. And that's basically what Bismarck engineers with the infamous Ems telegram and all the hoo-ha around that. So he just exploits basically a situation where the Spanish throne is vacant. The one of the candidates for it is a German prince, and Bismarck makes very little effort to convince the French that they're not serious in putting this German prince forward for it. And on the contrary, there's a lot of scheming. He gets a lot of people to whisper in French corridors and that sort of stuff, you know, that Germany is actually going to, or Prussia is actually going to do that. Which would have meant basically that France would have been surrounded by two Hohenzollerns, one in, you know, next to them basically in the east, and one in the south on the Spanish throne. And the last insult comes with that infamous Ems telegram, where basically the king, the Prussian king, was supposed to put that whole thing to bed and say, no, we have no interest in the Spanish succession. Talks to the ambassador that the French send over, Benedetti, and tells him, don't worry, we're not really interested, just go home and tell Napoleon this, Napoleon III, that is, this time.
Yeah.
tell him this, and gives that to Bismarck to put together as a nice communique that is very gently phrased so that the French can be reassured. And Bismarck does virtually the opposite and just phrases that telegram very rudely, makes it look as if the king had just dismissed Benedetti out of hand, and then sends it back to the French on Bastille Day, of all days, and leaks it to the press just in case the French government might be kind of, you know, rational enough not to take the bait. But once it goes out to the public on Bastille Day, that is it, and they can't do anything. Napoleon is under so much pressure internally, he might as well roll the dice, and otherwise he would have lost his position in any case.
With Germany's unification in 1871, a new state is suddenly created in the centre of Europe, which is more populous than France, Britain and Austria. Why are these European powers so afraid of the new Germany?
Well, they would be, wouldn't they, for the reason that you just mentioned. First of all, Germany had just fought, three wars to unify itself against Austria and Denmark and France. And secondly, it completely throws this very fragile European power balance out of kilter. And when you think about, especially Britain was very, you know, almost obsessed with this idea of you know, the balance of power in Europe and how that was going to keep the peace. I mean, you know, let's not forget that the Napoleonic Wars were a huge shock, and many people in Europe wanted there to be some sort of power system in Europe that would make sure that there isn't one domineering power.
Which has also been quite successful.
So yeah, absolutely. And suddenly you get this, new thing in the middle of it that's bigger than everything else. And nobody really knows.
With a plotter at his helm.
That's right.
Yeah,
and somebody that's just, you know, talked a lot about blood and iron, which is perhaps not really putting a lot of confidence in people's minds. And so Bismarck's got really a job on his hands there to start with, to try and convince people that this new Germany would be a peaceful force for good in Europe. And that's why he's doing all of this kind of stuff to try and establish Germany as an honest broker, with no imperial ambitions whatsoever. So it's not going to be a nuisance to anybody. If anything, it's going to be a stabilizing force on the continent, and that's sort of the route that is driving his foreign policy.
You're right that in the German Empire, Bismarck controlled every aspect of government to the point of obsession. How was he able to maintain such control despite power residing, at least in theory, with the Kaiser?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not that he actually managed to do that, but he wanted to do it. He was just such a control freak, like installing his son, for instance, Herbert, you know, into important positions and making him befriend the young future Kaiser Wilhelm II and that sort of stuff, to the point where he was even trying to control, you know, the sort of future heir of the realm. So, you know, and also I think Bismarck was under no illusion that a modern government of the way that he created it wasn't an absolute monarchy. You just cannot control that as a single person. But you mentioned the Kaiser there, and that is an important point, because he had, despite the fact that Bismarck wrote this constitution and designed it, he had still put the Kaiser on top of him. So there's still, you know, the Kaiser is technically the highest sort of instance in this new constitution. So Bismarck sort of relied a little bit on the idea that this constitution was written for him and Wilhelm I specifically. This doesn't work in the future with other people in those positions, because you sort of need... So if you imagine the Kaiser is kind of like... I like to use this metaphor of, like, imagine the country as a shop, basically.
Yeah.
The Kaiser is like the shop owner. and Bismarck as the chancellor is kind of the manager of the place. Mm-hmm. So the owner can go and enjoy himself and have a nice life whilst the manager runs a shop. And that's effectively what happens with Bismarck and Wilhelm I. He's quite happy, Wilhelm I, because he was a Prussian first and foremost and didn't really want this kind of Germany that was now foisted upon him. So he was happy to kind of go into his estates and go hunting and, you know, every now and then obviously come back and sign some laws and stuff. But really it was Bismarck who was behind all of the initiatives.
So did have a good relationship, Wilhelm I and Bismarck?
Yeah, I mean, depends what you mean by good. Bismarck had made himself completely indispensable to the Kaiser. I mean, this started with their relationship right from the beginning in 1861. When Wilhelm was still the King of Prussia and had an argument with Parliament over military reforms, desperate to the point of wanting to resign. And then Bismarck gets called back. He was the ambassador to France at this point, to Berlin, to sort this out. And basically, once he had sorted it out, he told Parliament, you know, his blood and iron and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. He gave that famous speech. And then ran an illegal army budget against Parliament, effectively. You know, did the military reforms anyway. And that's kind of his style. So he kind of just does stuff. But then nobody else could continue with it. It's the same with his foreign policy as well. He sets up this really complicated foreign policy network with reassurance treaties and kind of bilateral and multilateral agreements with different states. And then, you know, if he was dismissed or, you know, kind of even suppressed or blackmailed, say, or threatened by the Kaiser, he would just refuse to do it, you know, and then suddenly the whole thing would collapse. So Wilhelm is completely dependent and utterly dependent on him, and he knows it. So whether that's a good relationship, I don't know, but it's certainly a sort of symbiotic one that kind of works.
The following years are a boom time for German science, industry and colonialism. Yet you're right that the German Empire was perpetually plagued by the conflicts inherent in the process of its creation. What do you mean by that?
Well, Bismarck set the empire up in the constitution as a hybrid model between some very democratic elements and a lot of the autocratic elements remained from previous sort of incarnations of it. So you have this conflict between a parliament that is now elected by universal male election. So all males over the age of 25 can vote. And that's really quite revolutionary for the time. There's no social or sort of wealth limitations on that. So take that together with the advancing industrial revolution, you get a load of very politicized and now highly educated, because the education system is moving very quickly as well. Voters in the cities, workers, the proletariat is basically swelling its ranks, who are voting their representatives in the Reichstag. And yet Bismarck has made it so that there's no link between parliament, basically, and the executive. So as they're voting or wanting to create legislation that suits them, the Kaiser and the Chancellor and the entire cabinet are effectively completely independent of them. So you've got this detached kind of relationship between two parts of the constitution that are pulling in different directions, and neither can really control the other. And that's what I sort of meant by that, because they're really trying to do very different things with this Reich.
There's sort of an accident of history which seems momentous in hindsight, and that's the death of the Kaiser's son, Prince Frederick. What does this mean for the future of the empire?
A lot, really. I mean, this is one of the great big ifs, I suppose, in German history, because Frederick III was a liberal, married to Vicky, Queen Victoria's oldest daughter, and they had this vision of basically importing British liberalism into Germany and running the country not dissimilar to what Vicky had learned from her mother Victoria and then her German husband Albert. I mean, mm-hmm. the roles would have been reversed in terms of who the monarch and who the
yes.
consort is, but that's probably more on paper than in reality, because Vicky was certainly the more sort of sparky and intellectual of the two, mm-hmm. And would have most likely kind of driven the course behind the scenes. And that was certainly a vision that was there, and liberalism was still strong in Germany, and then there's certainly a chance that, you know, this would have had some uptake with the people and with those in powerful positions as well. But as you say, he died in 1888 after only 100 years and days even in power, basically put that entire thing to bed before it even had a chance to start. I mean, he was so ill with throat cancer that he couldn't even speak during his entire reign, so very, very little impact that the two of them were able to have on German politics.
As you argue, older historians tend to downplay the influence of the new Kaiser, Wilhelm II, in German politics. Why did he do that?
Well, he's an odd character, really, because of what follows afterwards with the First World War. People tend to either see him as a buffoon and some sort of comical, you know, figure, or thereby downplaying his role in the period up to the First World War. Or they see him as a sort of dictator type, you know, figure who was keen to go to war and was therefore driving everything from 1888 to 1914 in that direction. And the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. As you know, I wouldn't quite go as far. I mean, we won't hopefully go into the ins and outs of the question why the First World War broke out.
No, no.
But Wilhelm's role has been really densely contested, and it doesn't really help that he's become a bit of a persona non grata, really, I would say, in German history, by German historians who haven't really dared touch the topic as much as others have. I mean, the two big biographers are, you know, Ruhl and Clark. One's British, the other Australian. You know, yeah. that tells you everything you know about, you know, you need to know about German.
But Wilhelm II, he shakes up the establishment. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's a young Kaiser. People tend to forget that when he comes into power. Yeah. You know, he's not even 30 years old at this point. And that makes a huge break from Wilhelm I, who had arguably just lived too long. You know, that was part of the problem, really, that he dragged this. He was born in the century before that, you know, in 1797, I think. You know, and dragged that piece of kind of this previous age with him still into a modern New Germany had just been created. So people were initially really excited when Wilhelm comes into power, and he's got an almost kind of childlike interest in technology and you know, goes into the factories, sees the ships roll out and all of that sort of stuff, and travels around Germany a lot, the scene everywhere, loves to court like public you know, attention in the sense that he loves giving speeches and going out and talking to people. And all of that initially seems very exciting to a lot of Germans, because they see him as a young, modern version of a Kaiser. But at heart, he's such a staunch conservative at the same time that this conflict really plays out, I would say, in the way that he runs Germany, or certainly in the way that he presents himself to the Germans and to the world.
Well, you wanted to avoid to discuss what started the Great War, but the looming presence in this new era is, of course, the Great War. And its causes have been endlessly debated with historian Christopher Clark, who you quote in the book. He recently argued that Europe was sleepwalking to disaster. Did the Kaiser or Bismarck see this crisis coming? That's, I think, it's an important question.
Did the Kaiser see it coming?
Or Bismarck.
Well, there's this famous Bismarck quote, isn't there, from the 1880s, where he said, you know, a great war is going to come out of some damn foolish thing in the Balkans. So yes, he did sort of see it coming, which I think a lot of people did. I mean, the situation with, you know, all the factors have been have been discussed a lot, but with the crumbling Ottoman Empire, at the same time, Austria-Hungary, you know, in sort of decline at this point, all of that is there. The tensions that creates in Europe are all there. And perhaps the Kaiser Wilhelm II, that is, wasn't the most attuned to those things in the way that Bismarck would have been if he'd still been alive at this point. He dies, obviously, well before that. But what I try to stress in the book is that even on the eve of war, so after the assassination of Franz Ferdinand on the 28th of June 1914, he still goes on his annual cruise on holiday, asks kind of his advisors, you know, do you think that makes sense? Can I still go? And they go, yeah, fine, go. But the fact that he doesn't realise just the scale of the whole thing, and pretty much spends the entire July crisis away, you know, with his Dachshunds on a cruise ship, tells you, I think, that he certainly didn't see what the next 4 years would have in store. I mean, there was always a strong possibility that this would lead to war, but war was still, and again, we forget this now after two world wars, but war was still seen as a fairly legitimate, you know, part of politics, really.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, Wilhelm's only experience, you know, was the Franco-Prussian War. He was still a boy then. You know, this is not something that people saw as a huge calamity. If, you know, if war breaks out, let it was sort of the I think the attitude that Willem had towards these things. So, you know, whilst I think he has got to take a fair amount of the blame, simply because he's the Kaiser, he's the head of the military, I don't think he saw coming, and I don't think many other people did, what modern technology and the alliance system and all the other factors would do to what would have probably been a fairly small-scale conflict in the Balkans, as far as Willem was concerned.
In the Treaty of Versailles, the Entente powers, France, Britain and the United States, they blame German militarism for starting the war. Looking back at the pre-war years, is it fair to say that Germany was a martial society?
Yes and no. I mean, Prussia was, and has been for a long time, and that's to do with the way that it started and evolved. I mean, you know, Clark goes into this quite a lot in his Iron Kingdom book, and does it really well as well. I think the idea that Prussia kind of is where it is, you know, in Central Europe, without obvious physical boundaries, constantly threatened by those around it, and then goes to a concept of like a militia army effectively to try and deal with that, namely arming its own citizens and asking it to go to arms each time there's conflict. That raises like a spirit almost within the Prussian people of, you know, it's their civic duty to defend their country. And then obviously you've got, you know, the soldier king, all of that basically doesn't really help with that, in that it really instills like a sort of military cult in many Prussians. But equally, people forget that it's also, you know, an extremely liberal country at the same time, and harbors a strong liberal element all the way through, even well before Napoleon as well. And both of those traditions are there still in 1914, I'd say, as well, and are at odds with each other. And people find it difficult sometimes, I think, to see the nuances in that, and see beyond the militarism and see that side as well. So those two, I think, clash. And the main thing, though, is what I said earlier about this defense of nationalism thing. The moment you raise that, I think that was a really powerful psychological trigger in Germany. So this idea, once again, Germany is surrounded by enemies. If it stands together, you know, it will not fall. All of this Napoleonic stuff comes back. The rhetoric is exactly the same. You know, this time we can do it because we are standing together. Look what we did in 1871 when we stood together. It's that kind of thing that convinces people in 1914 that this isn't the end of the world and they can do this in a relatively short amount of time.
One of the most fascinating conclusions of your book is that while the German state was in many respects artificial, it nonetheless created a new national sentiment. How was this achieved?
Largely, in my opinion, with the First World War, that certainly compounded it. I mean, by 1914, you see this in people's rhetoric and in the way that they speak about Germany, it's there. So even the Kaiser himself, Wilhelm, is arguably the first actual German Kaiser, in the sense that he takes on this identity and cultivates it and wants to be the Kaiser of all Germans, and not just a Prussian king. And in fact, I would say, in contrast to his grandfather, he values that position much higher than being the Prussian king. So that's there. But I think the collective experience of like the mass violence of the First World War, the collective humiliation, defeat, you know, the women and children at home suffering from the lack of food and so on. I think because the First World War touched everyone in a fairly similar way, and in a really profound way as well, it made them, it sort of compounded that nation really, once again, as I was sort of, you know, saying in the book as well, in Blood and Iron, only this time it destroyed it, basically, certainly the political structures around it. But in the destruction of that, it still created, you know, whilst the state was destroyed, the nation, in my opinion, was compounded by it.
Germany remains arguably the most powerful state in continental Europe, albeit with a very different constitution to Bismarck's. You write much on contemporary German politics too. So what insights has this period to offer for students of today's Germany, you think?
A fair bit, I think. I think it's actually been undervalued, I think, in that respect. I mean, for starters, one of the points I make quite a lot is that when Germany was founded in 1871, it hadn't quite found an identity because it was so new and, as you say, fairly artificial because it was created from scratch, and not because everyone wanted or needed it at that point. So that meant that Germany hadn't an identity that had naturally evolved. as either, say, a Western state or a European state or, you know, whatever, really. And so it's constantly where it's sat, in my opinion, looking both east and west rather than just west. So it's often mentioned in one breath with Britain, France, the US as a Western nation, which it is. But what people get confused about, you know, with kind of Germany's pro-Russia politics, for example, is that that's exactly what Bismarck did as well. You know, there's this huge Russian state sat the other side of Germany, which, you know, it somehow has to deal with and interact with. It can't just pretend it's not there. And that's always been part of Germany's identity as well, but not in a fixed sort of way that's still fluid, in my opinion. And still hasn't been, you know, sort of set in stone what Germany's relationship is to the countries around it. And that, I think, still has ramifications on politics today, for example. And the other big thing, I think, is the implications for German democracy. So the way that it took Germany such a long time to develop a healthy relationship to democracy, because initially, yes, it's set up as a democratic state in 1871, reasonably so, a half democracy, where people can go and vote for a meaningful array of political parties. But that's not because people have argued and fought for that and bled for it, but it's just there suddenly in 1871, and people go, fine, I'll vote then. And they do vote. I mean, turnout remains remarkably high throughout German history, so Germans do go and vote even when they're grumpy. They go and still vote for something and then grumble about it, but they will go and vote. So that, you know, is an interesting one as well, because it's normally just dismissed as a, you know, militaristic state, and German democracy to many people tries to start in the Weimar Republic and fails, and then really only kicks off in West Germany in 1949. And I would be cautious about that, because it does root itself, for instance, even with the flag and everything else, and the liberal movements of the 19th century. You know, you've got the tricolour, the German tricolour, coming out of the 1848 revolutions, as does the anthem, the German national anthem. So Germany itself in 1949 was quite conscious of its previous history of democracy, but this is often not taken seriously enough, because the question then arises, why does it abolish itself in 1914, you know, when they sign an enabling act handing powers over to the executive, and people are reasonably happy with that. There's very little demand to get that back during the war and you know, afterwards. It's again given back to Germans, but a lot of Germans, you know, have got a fairly indifferent attitude towards democracy in the 1920s as well. And that, I think, is an interesting one to look at.
Katja Hoyer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.